Are we good? Oh, we're good to roll. Good morning, Tech Ed. That was not bad, but I think we can do a little better than that. Good morning, Tech Ed. Let's let the people next door to us hear you. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. And welcome to our session today on Windows 8 security internals, which is going to be super deep, hardcore, geeky. So we're going to try and make it as fun as we can. I started out to really honor my commitment to make this nerdy by ensuring that there was no PowerPoints, not even when you walked in the door. You're welcome. However, what I didn't realize is that there's actually a rule at Microsoft that if you work here, you have to use PowerPoint. So I thought, how can I use PowerPoint and keep it geeky enough? And then I thought, wow, I just need to start PowerPoint the nerdy way. So we'll go ahead and use the standard PowerPoint start sequence. This is how you guys start PowerPoint, I'm sure. You set a breakpoint on user 32, set window text W, and we'll feed in the argument to modify the EAX register. Right? This is how you guys do, right? Every time you're going to start it up, Outlook is very, very similar. Untitled PowerPoint. And let's do disable all the breakpoints and go conditionally. And, oh, that's awesome. Okay, I think we're good. And now we have started our PowerPoint. But I did want to take the time to outline exactly what this session is, because security is one of those really, really big words that can mean all kinds of things. It could mean the kinds of things that we sell you in little boxes that cost lots of money. It could be the kinds of things that scare you about, hey, what if someone's hacking into me? This is not that talk. This talk is specifically looking at the infrastructure of Windows that discusses how Windows works to bring application trust back in. What's going on at the OS level? And we're really going to target ourselves towards what goes on for Windows 8 applications, the new modern applications, the things I used to be able to call Metro before it got me in trouble for saying it. Oops. But that's what we're going to talk about. If that's not what you think you came to hear about, but you like security, my friend Paul is two doors down talking about people hacking into your environment, and that'll also be a really good talk. It won't hurt my feelings if you leave now. It will probably hurt my feelings if you leave at the end and go, wow, that was not at all what I expected, as long as I live up to what I just told you about. Is that a fair deal? All right. So what I want to do is really set the stage. And, you know, I've been working in the Windows space for a while. A little bit about my background. I'm often known as the AppCompat guy, and that's my Twitter handle. It's my email at Microsoft. I'm appcompatguy@microsoft.com. I'm pretty easy to find. For about the past 6 years, I've worked on getting applications working as the entire ecosystem evolves. And what caused apps to fail? By and large, moving off of Windows XP. What one feature do you think killed more than anything else in the history of all features? UAC. How many people think that they really understand all the way to the core exactly what UAC does? Yeah. So we're going to talk about that. So yes, a lot of this stuff is Vista-era stuff, but it's foundational. It's what we've been building up upon. In fact, how many people have UAC turned off on the device they have in this room right now? One, two. There's two of you. There's one iPad and two UAC disablers. I walk around and look. A lot of surfaces here. I'm happy to see that. So that's what we're going to set the foundation with. Here's what UAC really is and why it's foundational. And when I say foundational, we don't even bother running Windows 8 apps if you turn UAC off. They won't work. So if you're on Windows 7 today and you've turned it off, and you go to Windows 8 and you try to run something, it's not going to do anything. Not only that, do you lose this entire application ecosystem, there's another subtle problem that you're going to have, which is we don't know what you can expect. The amount of testing that we do at Microsoft on Windows with UAC disabled is precisely zero. We have no clue what happens if you flip that switch. So that adds to your risk as well. So let's talk about that. And what I'll do is I'm just going to start by taking a look at the token. I'm going to use the who am I command. We're going to keep it in the console as long as we can and really dissect what's going on in my user token. And let's go ahead and get one running as admin as well. /all/sfo/list and get those going. The admin one is red. The non-admin one is blue. There's no magic to why that happens, right? So a little extra bonus presentation tip. You know how I make one red and one blue? I start them from different shortcuts. I always start my non-elevated one from Windows R CMD, and I always start my elevated one from typing the word command at the start menu. Different shortcuts persist different color schemes, and that's how I do that. So just to demystify what's going on behind the curtain. And let's take a look at what we have in these two tokens. So here's this one, here's the other one. Let's scroll to the top. Rather conveniently, it doesn't fit. So let's go ahead and increase the buffer size on this one. Let's do 999. Try that again. And we'll start spelunking. So inside of the token, the one thing you'll notice is that on both my elevated and non-elevated tokens, it's me. The exact same me. Exact same Sid. Everything is identical. In fact, if I can get them lined up here, you can see, number for number, they're perfect. Well, yeah, good timing on the scroll. That was awesome. Oh, and you still don't have it all. That is incredibly inconvenient. Did I do the wrong thing here? Buffer size, height, oh, let's do 1,000 there. Boy, how many times am I going to restart that demo? I'm really good at computing. So let's start going down the non-elevated token and seeing what's going on. So one point of confusion I get all the time, hey, I'm a member of the admins group. Admins are allowed to do something here. I'm not allowed to do it. That is inherently self-contradictory. What is happening is that we've put a little flag on the admins group when you're not elevated. And this attribute right here. It's the deny only flag, which means I cannot use my membership in this group to grant myself permission to something. I can only use it to deny me access to something. So therefore, if I'm trying to write someplace, I won't be able to because that is an allow request, and allows are going to get denied. What kinds of requests am I going to be allowed or denied? Well, the way that I think about it is this. There's the fundamental difference between a standard user and an admin is a standard user can hork all of their own stuff. An admin can hork everybody else's stuff. Hork is a very distinct technical term. It means to mess up. But you're not allowed. And so you can use that to think your way through it. As an admin, if I'm trying to get into program files is shared by everybody. So if I can change it, I can hork up somebody else's stuff. My documents belongs to me. Everyone gets one. So if I can change it, I only mess up my stuff. Therefore, it's allowed. So I have this admin token, and I have this flag on it when I have it filtered. And that's what we call it, is this filtered token that says deny only versus what we see here, which is mandatory group enabled by default. You can see it flipping back and forth. In red, it's just a regular old group. In blue, we flip the deny only flag. But it's still me. And this is really fundamentally different from anything else out there. If I go to Unix or Mac OS X or any other variants of that, Android, blah, 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 there is no sense of two different versions of the same identity. You have you and you have root. This is literally the same you with different flavors. As we scroll down, we see I still have all of my same group memberships, which is entirely too many. Clearly, I'm working too hard. So anyone who's ever seen me work knows that can't possibly be true. And eventually, we get to the next area where things are different. And that is this mandatory level. We'll talk about that in a bit, because that's also very fundamental to what we're doing. And finally, we get to privileges at the very, very bottom. Privileges are an escape hatch where you say, here's where I'm going to allow you to bend the rules. Remember the fundamental rules, you can't mess up other people's stuff. Privileges are, unless it's this stuff. So privileges will be things like SE backup. What does SE backup do from an OS level? It sounds like you'd let me do backups, right? SE backup lets me read whatever I want to on the file system without an access check. So I'm allowed to look at everything. SE restore lets me write whatever I want to without an access check. You can see where if I have that, it's kind of dangerous. So what do we have in my filter token? The filter token is designed to look an awful lot like a standard user. This is the same privileges you will get as a standard user. What can you do? What privileges do I give you to break the rules? I'll let you shut down the computer. Shutting down the computer technically breaks the rule, because if you shut it down, you are by definition impacting anyone else who's using the computer. But if I don't let you shut it down, it's kind of not a very good computer for you. If I don't let you undock it, that's going to affect other users because the computer is about to walk away. But we need to be able to undock it, so we give you a privilege. One of the things, did anyone ever run a standard user on XP? A couple folks did. It was really, really hard. And I once had someone really just tear into me. It was someone whose company had run all standard users. And she was a road warrior like me. I met her in a hotel room lobby. I had a Microsoft shirt on. I subsequently stopped wearing them because I don't like being yelled at. And she's like, oh, I hate this. I can't even change my time zone. You couldn't change your time zone on Windows XP as a standard user, which makes it really hard to go anywhere because your clock's always wrong. Why is that? Well, that's because the changing the system time is an admin level right. Changing the time zone was tied to it. And technically, you are impacting other users of the computer because you're changing what their time will say as well. That being said, it's important for real world scenarios to be able to do that. Changing the time, why is that an admin right? Well, because when you think about repudiability, if I want to deny that I did something, here's what I can do. Change the system time to some time when I know I'm going to be verifiably nowhere near that device. Then do the naughty thing. Then change the time back. And then make sure I go somewhere and get my picture taken somewhere nowhere near that device with a clock at the bottom so I can say, it wasn't me. Here's a picture of me at this time. Violates repudiability. That's a big security problem, so we don't allow that. So we added that. So I have these few, but I don't have all these other things, like the ability with the debug privilege to get into any process I want to without having to pass an access check. All those things come along with it. So I have these two flavors, one that I slice down and the other that happens normally. And how that gets implemented is we have win logon. This is how I do slides. Win logon will go through and create your elevated token, and then it will create your filtered token, and then it will log on to Explorer using the filtered token. And how tokens are passed back and forth between systems, you know, it's not fork per se, but you inherit your token from your parent process. Explorer is running with your filtered token, which means by default you're going to inherit that filtered token. And that's how it works, right? A consequence, a side effect of this, if you will, is that this is one of the consequences of the architecture a couple folks have run into. Lots and lots of folks, by which I mean every single company I've ever worked with, use map network drives. Map network drives are associated with a logon session. There are two distinct logon sessions. We actually create a new one for each of those. So guess what? Your non-elevated token and your elevated token have two different collections of mapped network drives. The reason is architectural, and it's been that way for a long time. You can go to XP or 2000 or NT4 and do a run as.exe as yourself to get a second logon session with this exact same identity. It works. And then go list your map network drives, and if you don't run a script, they won't be there. We didn't change the behavior, but we changed the frequency with which you will have two different logon sessions so that suddenly sometimes people notice. Right? There is a registry setting you can use to try and line those up. We don't do it perfectly. We don't make them a single collection, but that's a consequence of the architecture. The other thing I want to explain is how we do elevation at all. We've got shell execute being the API that goes through and determines if you need elevation. And if you do, we call into the app info service. The app info service, if it needs to show UI, calls into consent.exe. And if you say yes, it will create the process, create process as user, and then it will reparent it so that it looks like the parent process is the one that called shell execute. Why does that matter? Why am I drawing that on the screen? Is that even legible because I have terrible handwriting? A consequence of this that I've seen in the real world is what happens if I'm trying to pass information to my child process via environment variables. Doesn't happen very often, but I've seen it a couple times. Environment variables you inherit from your parent process. Who's the actual parent process of the elevated process? The app info service. So we inherit the environment variables from the app info service and not the app that tried to launch it. So potentially some impact. But that's how we do elevation. And the other part of that is that the calling into consent and how that works. We're going to have a little something for everybody. Here's the group policy editor. Later I'm going to have Visual Studio, so hopefully those of you who are developers and write code will be okay for just a minute, and those of you who are IT admins, you'll be okay a little bit later on. We got something for everybody here. But I wanted to explain that it's not guaranteed that it's always a prompt. So if I go into the local policies and go into security options and take a look at it, there are two different sets of behaviors that are defined. What about admins and what about standard users? The thing I will point out is this policy right here. Run all administrators in admin approval mode. Is UAC on or UAC off? So Windows 8, if you go to the slider and bring it all the way down, that is not UAC off. Group policy can still turn it off. And as I mentioned earlier, that's a really horrible idea. This is the on-off switch. The behavior that we have for admins, I have choices. The bottom of the prompter, of the slider, is elevate without prompting. That means anything that asks to be elevated will just always say yes. No prompt, nothing gets in your way. If you just hate prompts and that's your motivation for turning off UAC, that makes prompts go away forever. It also means that bad guys get to be admin just by saying, hey, I kind of like to be admin. Well, okay, there you go. No problem. In between, we have, oh, just ask me yes or no, all the way up to make me type my password again, which is actually what a lot of people were arguing for when we initially designed the feature back in the Windows Vista timeframe. Oh, let's make them type it again just to make sure that they're serious about it. Yeah, that was a pretty terrible idea. You know what the most effective setting I've ever done was? When I set up my folks and I turned UAC on, I had them both be admins, and my dad will hose a computer in a week. Right? He cannot resist the temptation of whatever it takes to get the dancing monkeys on his screen. He'll say yes. So I said, all right, Dad, you're no longer an admin. I'm tired of rebuilding your box. Mom, you're the admin. And that lasted sometimes 2 or 3 months, but then we'd still get the box. Something would get on it. I wouldn't know. I never said yes. What I did was I made it so that she was a standard user, and standard users have a different policy. Oops, wrong one, that guy right there, which can be auto deny or prompt for credentials, and we'll talk about how to choose that one. I put them on prompt for credentials, put an account on there for me, didn't put a password on it, but put my picture on it. So now every single time it goes for elevation, it shows her a picture of my face smiling at her, and she thinks, oh, would Chris actually do this? Because she sees me looking at her, and I haven't had to rebuild the box since. So just a little tip there. When I'm talking about running it in an enterprise environment, the question then becomes, well, what do I do for my standard users? Well, I can either automatically deny or I can ask them to type something. And the ask them to type something bit unless you run the type of organization where you literally have IT help desk guys walking the halls waiting for someone to raise their hand, right, which is kind of how it works in my house, right? One of my daughters raises her hand, and I, hey, what's this thing here? And then I will cause that to come up and then determine whether I can do that. That's the default setting for your house, not as good for the enterprise. It's all a matter of help desk. How is help desk going to get elevated permissions? Do they want to be able to right-click, run as admin, and type their credentials? Or do you want them to have to do a separate login? You also need to figure out from the secure desktop side whether or not your software supports that. By which I mean the secure desktop is not remoted by much of anything. We have a policy that should get it around it. It's called only elevate UI access applications that are installed in secure locations. Let me actually translate this from group policy to English for you. Only allow MSRA.exe to elevate without, oh, that's the wrong policy. Now you guys are really confused. Let me actually show the right one on the screen. It'll make sense. There, the secure desktop one. Only applies to MSRA.exe, and what MSRA.exe is doing is using undocumented APIs, so nobody else could do it. So that's a very poorly named policy. In general, what I have reverse engineered is this. The way that we at Microsoft name our group policies, right, we just get people in a room, we get a keyboard, and we just bash our face into it, and whatever English words come out, we just take them. So these are the policies. So when we think about what it means to elevate and how that happens, we need to devise a coherent strategy. How am I going to make this elevation take place? So far, so good. Two different groups. We need to figure out how to elevate. How is help desk going to work? What software am I using? And build out that strategy. Next question when it comes to UAC. All right, elevation, I can see right-click run as admin, but obviously I don't want to have to remember, oh, this app gets launched this way. Sometimes it comes up when I don't ask for it. What makes an app prompt or not prompt? And there's a really, really common misperception that elevation is something that happens based on a need to be elevated. Oh, I'm about to do something that's privileged, so let me get your permission first. And it's actually not that simple. So inside of a Windows process, you have access to a token from every single thread running in the process. Everyone can use it. So once we introduce an elevated token into the process, it's considered compromised. Every single bit of code that might be running, whether it's your code or something that was injected or anything else, has access to this elevated token. It's dangerous. We don't elevate in place. Elevation happens when you are starting a new program. So if you see a prompt, there's always, 100% of the time, a new process being created. So how do we know whether to elevate? Well, we certainly can't just iterate through all of the x86 assembly language and figure out if it's going to do something along the way, because there are all kinds of things that are impossible to figure out statically. We have to see them at runtime. That means we have to guess. And we really, really have to guess to solve an important scenario. So here's some historical statistics to think way back in the day. Every single day on the Windows team, we run tests, automated tests, on lots and lots of software that's commercially available. We actually will go to the Best Buy with a pickup truck and buy one of each and throw them in the back, right, to that level, just to make sure that we have the exact same thing that the world sees. And so at the time for Windows Vista, we had an excess of 1,000 apps. We're well over 5,000 now because we keep adding to the library. Every single day we test them, and we measure our success rate, what worked on the previous one and doesn't work now. And on the XP to Windows Vista transition, we had an area where, all right, so we're at about 90, I think the day before Beta 2 build started, so basically the day Beta 1 shipped, we were at about 96, 97%, somewhere in there, of apps that worked on XP, still worked on, at the time, what we called Longhorn. The next day, the first Beta 2 build is the first build that enables UAC by default. Guess what happened on that day? 20%. And we're like, holy crap, 4 out of 5 pieces of software stopped working. And the big problem was they didn't install. So what do we do to get those things to work at all. And we thought, well, we can fix MSIs. That's easy. It turns out the world doesn't use only MSIs. Who would have thought? We had lots and lots of setup.exes out there, and none of them were installing. If they were elevated, they did. It wasn't all that bad, but we had to get them installed in the first place. So we said, you know what? We've got to go and find all of the installers. So we do. There are three reasons why you might elevate, why you might see a prompt if you see one. Reason number one, the developer has asked for it. Please elevate me. They put in a little bit of XML into the manifest for the application that says, I need elevation. We read it and go, oh, the developer wants it. Done. Reason number two, the IT pro has asked for it via a custom shim database. And anyone not familiar with custom shim databases at all? Is that new? So real basic, because there's one hand that went up. It's a way that an IT administrator can apply compatibility fixes to applications that they aren't wanting to change the code on for whatever reason. So it's a database. The create process, internal W actually is the function where it happens, will, when you're launching the app, check, hey, is there an entry in the database where we need to fix this thing up? If so, how do we fix it? So I can put a flag. This one needs elevation. Incidentally, the IT pro wins if you disagree. If the developer says, elevate me, and the IT pro goes, yeah, no, don't, the IT pro is the one who wins. But that's two, right? You get two people actively choosing on something. The final one is, we think you're a setup, because we went out to aggressively seek and find all of the things that were setups. And we do it, you can see the logic in this tool called Compatibility Administrator, which is what you use to make custom shim databases. You can actually see the exact logic that we use. We look in various parts of the string table, the internal name, the original file name, or even look if the name of the app itself contains the word setup. You can try this yourself, just rename one of your files, put the word setup in there, and suddenly you'll see a little shield icon pop up. So we think you're a setup. And the four key words are setup, update, right? Or, just in case you happen to be in Japan, we have both full width and half width katakana for apudetu. You can look it up. Patch. And, oops, let me go to the top again. And install under installer detection. And that's what we look for. So that's why you might elevate. If you're elevating, you're almost always because we think you're a setup, unless someone's asked for it. Right? So demystify that. There's nothing about we actually need it. It's that we predict that you probably might based upon a name, and we can be wrong. And if we're wrong, you can opt out. You can apply a flag to it. Either put a manifest that says, don't elevate me if you're a developer. If you're not a developer, if you've got someone else's code, you can always say specific non-installer, apply that flag to it, and the prompt will go away. No one understands this either. In fact, I was talking with a really large ISV, and they happen to make a product called Install Shield. Install Shield, since it sort of was originally, at one point, the name of the company, now it's owned by Flexera, all of the things that they use to run their internal business happen to have the word Install Shield in it. Now, we are aggressively trying to find the word Install Shield because for most everyone else, it means you're a setup. For them, it means all of our stuff, everything prompted in their environment. They're like, what the heck? You said prompts were going down in Windows 7, and they are nonetheless constant. It's like, oh, yeah, you are Install Shield. Yeah, you've got to turn that feature off. There's a group policy for that, too. So that's why we elevate, right? So far, so good. Now we're rolling along. We have two different tokens. We know how we get back and forth between them. We know the architecture in Windows. We know the rules. We know how to break the rules when we need to. Let's get back to this concept of integrity levels, also very foundational to what we're doing. So let's go ahead. Do I have a regular old window open? Yeah, I do. And we'll start using some tools from sysinternals. So my buddy Mark will be in here right after me, so you can tell him that I used his stuff. And we're going to launch PSExec. We're going to launch Notepad. with low integrity. And then we're going to start spelunking. So one of the columns that I added to SysInternals Process Explorer is the column that shows me integrity. And I can sort on it, and you can see what this thing is. Integrity, it's a way of doing authorization based on the extent to which you trust a process. So you can trust it a lot or a little, but now it's no longer just this giant app soup where everything has the same permissions, which is what it is on Windows XP. On Windows XP, if you, like, you know what, I have to be an admin for some reason because when I'm doing my builds in Visual Studio, I need to register these COM components, or when I'm, you know, running this tool, it needs to be admin on the box, it's changing something, so I'm running as admin. So is everything else, including your web browser. So basically, if you're running as admin on Windows XP, so is the entire internet. We thought, maybe we don't want to have everything be equally trusted. Let's start tiering that. So now not only do we have two identities, we have separate levels of trust within that identity based on the process itself. Now, the concept of integrity itself is implemented as a SID. And you can see the SID here in Process Explorer 16384. And technically, internally, the representation is a 32-bit number. And there are, therefore, 4 billion different possible integrity levels. We didn't think we really needed 4 billion. That's a little bit more than we actually needed. So we really use about 4, leaving us 4 billion minus 4 to play around with at some point in the future if we choose to. But we look at system, which is what your services normally run at. We dove into high, which are things that are running as administrators, kind of how you can conceptualize it. Medium is the stuff that's running as standard user. And then low are things that are untrusted. And I just launched Notepad in this low construct. App container also is low. We'll actually take a look here and see our integrity is low. But Mark also happens to point out it is additionally in an app container. And we'll talk about that when we get to the Windows 8 bits. So system, high, medium, low, implemented as a SID. And now at low, here I have this low integrity process. Let me just make sure it's the right one. Here's Notepad, and it is running at low. Now, how it works from an access check perspective is this. The default ACLs on anything, you've got an integrity level and a policy. Or an integrity label and a policy. Let me get my terminology correct. The integrity label will be system, high, medium, low. What level do I want to set it at? And the policy will be, do I want to allow read up, write up, or execute up? The default, if I do nothing, is medium, no write up. That means a medium integrity process is going to be able to do whatever it wants to. High can reach down, easy peasy. System can reach down. Low will be able to read stuff, but won't be able to write to it. And that, incidentally, is why we call it mandatory integrity control. It protects the integrity of the system, as opposed to, say, mandatory privacy control, which would stop it from reading things. So with medium no write-up, let's say I were to try and create, let me actually make sure I don't have one. Just hanging out in here, in documents. Yeah, let me go ahead and delete file.txt and make a test. And we'll just save that as file.txt. And you can see one of the very, very important lessons of app compat, don't believe dialog boxes. People try to guess what went wrong, right? And they're like, hey, I can't write there. You're probably writing to an admin spot because what idiot would run me at low integrity? This idiot. So why don't you try writing it in a documents folder instead? Okay. Let's try that. How about the documents folder instead? And I can do this all night. It'll never get me anywhere because it's low integrity. How would I get around that? Do I want things to write to low if I wanted to start protecting it? Well, yes, I could make a new file. Let me go ahead and get one to exist. So new text file, We'll just call it file.txt. And then we'll get back to the command line over here. And I'm going to use a tool that Mark Manassi wrote, another friend of mine, just because it saved me from writing some code. CHML lets me modify the integrity levels. And I can, let me go to documents. CHML, file.txt. And I'm going to set the integrity level to low. And once it's marked as low, I'm able to save. Right, so now I have a file that says untrusted people can write to me. This is what Internet Explorer has to do. Internet Explorer, by default, runs at low. So it has to mark everywhere it wants to write to allow low people to write to it. Otherwise, it's going to be partitioned off and won't be able to get there. Right? The other thing I could do with these policies is I could say, you know what? Let's get this guy back at medium. And now if I try to save, I'm going to get access denied. I can't do it. But what I could do, let me go ahead new and open it. If I wanted to see what was in there, I can read it. It hasn't protected my privacy. Now, the framework lets us do that if we wanted to. So I could do it at medium and block readups as well. Try to open it. There's file.txt. And what I did before we actually run it, is I changed the integrity level and set no readup to be enabled. So now, if I were to try and open it and read it, I could protect it. I do this in my Quicken file. I'm like, it's the only thing I got that's of any value. But you could use it that way. Why don't we do it by default? App compat. Too many things break if we default and nothing can read. And if we protect nothing, then nothing would break. But then, of course, we wouldn't actually move forward. So I have this concept of different levels, integrity levels, and levels of trust for a process that applies to the file system, and it also applies to what we do in terms of Windows. Now, one of the things that very few people understand, even developers don't understand, is the way that Windows works. So let me actually just do a quick demo of that. Open up the calculator. Windows does not have the sense of properties, right? Windows is a message-driven architecture. Every single application in the world, how it works is you have a win main entry point, if it's a Windows application, that starts it up, and it starts up your message loop. And then it sits there and receives the messages and processes them. The mouse moves, it sends a message. The mouse moved! It grabs it. What do I do if the mouse moves? And go run this code, right? And then back in loop again. It's a constant loop. Loop, 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 read things. And you can see that if you were to take a look here with the spy and say, yeah, give me the calculator window. I want to see all of the messages. You can see just how chatty this thing is. Oh, that's awesome. That's really helpful. I think I'm running. Let's try this again. I may have the wrong bitness here. Great demo. Let's try anywhere in here. Maybe. Oh no, I must have the wrong bitness. What is this guy? We'll do an active debug. See, what I like to say is, given the nature of what I do, I can never have a failed demo. I can only have unplanned debugging demos. So here we are in Spy++, and that's the problem. I'm running 32-bit Spy++, which means I need a 32-bit calculator, and I can do that. Windows syswow64 calc.exe. We've got a 32-bit calculator. Did you know you had two calculators on your machine? Because now you do. Now we can process those messages, and you can see how chatty it is. This is how Windows works. You have these messages. and we just, they just sent back and forth. You can send it. If you want to send a message to a calculator, all you have to do is say, hey, find this window, which, hey, it's called this, give me the handle to it, and then I can send a message to it. And I can send a message from anything to anything else, and guess what? No security descriptors. So I can do it to anything. So if you're now you're thinking, I've got different levels of trust, but if the thing is, I've got a window on my screen, it might have a little flag in the lower left-hand corner that pretty much everyone knows is there nearly all of the time. So if you're not going to let me do it, I'll just have Explorer do it for me. Kind of a nice back door that's wide open and banging on the shutters, right? Big problem. So we had to protect against that as well. So on the top of this level of integrity, we also said, you know what, let's fix our ability to take advantage of that back door through something called user interface privilege isolation that says you can't use window messages to get around it. Because what happens if you can use window messages to do naughty things is you'll just send messages such as this. No hands on the keyboard. I can exploit it using window messages. That lets me protect them, right? Because the reason why that didn't work is that this window right here is running at medium. It's doing elevated stuff, but it's running it at medium IL. But I have the ability to run it at high IL. If I look here, here's this process. I'll find it again. Really? You're not going to find it for me? Because that's your job. New user.exe, which is running at high. And because it's running at high IL, I can't get into it. So I've closed the back door with this concept of user interface privilege isolation. I can't get it around that. Interestingly, it does require you design your application correctly. So you saw this one was vulnerable because it does an elevated task with a non-elevated window. I can't think of anyone that would do elevated tasks, I don't know, like changing the time with non-elevated windows. I just don't think it happens in the real world. I can't imagine any real world thing where that would actually happen. So I'll just use this as a side note. The reason why I'm still talking about UAC, you can be a developer on the Windows team and not understand all of UAC. So it's okay if you've learned something new so far. So that is all foundational. That's what Windows 8 is starting from. It's all additive, right? And if you turn off UAC, all of that goo goes away. Now let's get into actual Windows 8 stuff, because that's, after all, the title of the session. We are 45 minutes into it, but the foundations, people don't get. And people don't get because it's legitimately hard. If you get it, you should be really proud because there aren't many people. Trust me, we still field every single day questions internal to Microsoft. So, we're going to bring up a Windows 8 app. And we're going to show some code. It's C++ code. You don't have to be a developer. If you are a developer, it lets you follow along. I'm simply going to point out a few facts about it and what it means. First things first, let's get this application running. And here's the app. And what the app is going to do, I just took a sample because I'm really, really lazy like any good developer. I didn't want to write an empty page with some buttons on it, so I took someone else's empty page with buttons and customized what the buttons did. That's how lazy I am. Try to top that. And I said, all right, here's this app. Let's go look at its token. So I have the app called fileaccess.exe, and I can go and find it. It's suspended because it no longer has the focus. Open up, baby. There we go. And let's start spelunking around there. So what we're doing first and foremost is we are dropping this thing into low integrity. So it's running as me, and it's running at low integrity, kind of like how Internet Explorer runs at low integrity, to kind of protect it for the rest of your system from this untrusted thing. Now we're protecting the rest of your system from these untrusted apps, right? Because here's our goal. Our goal is to bring trust back. Why did Windows take off in popularity? Is it because no one else knew how to do a windowed operating system with a keyboard and mouse? Were we the only ones? No, it was the apps, right? Apps and manageability and a whole story. But the real thing is I can get stuff done, and that's why people loved it. And that's why it exploded in the 90s, because there's so many apps and we kept them running. That's why people love App Compat, because they like their stuff to be durable. But here's the problem. Here's what's been happening. When I think about apps, I want to go get more. And we used to go and be able to get shareware and be trusted, right? And not very often would you come into something bad. Right now, it's estimated that up to a third of every executable file you can download from the internet either is or contains malware. Which means you would be smart not to trust anything you find. So here's this platform with millions upon millions upon millions of apps. Hooray! And a third of them are dangerous and will try to kill me. Not a really great environment. How do we bring trust back so you'll go and get arbitrary apps? Well, you've got to start containing them, right? We did that for the web. It's a little bit less dangerous to be popping around the web if you can't hork your system. Your privacy may still be at risk, potentially, as we discussed, if something bad gets in there, but at least your system won't be horked because we've put it down into this sandbox. But here's a problem. I put this at low, and my web browser is at low, and I get a whole bunch of apps that are all running at low. All I've done is I've made a new app soup running at a lower level. And they're all still mixing and matching together. I haven't solved the problem of one bad guy can take down all of my other stuff and my web browser. How do I do that? So let's start working our way through that, right? So low integrity. Let's go back over to this application, and we're going to use the Windows APIs to try and write something. Let's look at the code itself. I'm going to write it to the documents library. And it's going to work. I'm going to think, okay, that's odd. Why does that work? So let's go and look in our friend Process Explorer, or Process Monitor, and see what it's doing. I go to write to it. It's going to create that file. Let's stop Process Explorer, and let's add a filter, or erase the whole thing so I can start over, because I don't know how to hit the right key. That's awesome. We'll write it again, go back to Process Explorer, stop monitoring, filter, and we're going to look for where the path contains sample. And let's look at the specific sample.dat. .dat. Remove the extraneous stuff. And take a look at what's happening. Well, we got a little bit of noise because search found it and said, ooh, let me index that for you. So let's go ahead and get the search out of there. My antivirus went ahead and scanned it. And I looked at it in Explorer, so let's exclude that. Note that fileaccess.exe isn't writing it. This thing called runtimebroker.exe is. So I'm at low integrity. I can't write to documents because it's in my documents, and the default is medium no write-up. And I'm writing, which means someone else has to do it. Windows 8 apps have this companion that says, hey, I'll go ahead and do it for you, and it's responsible for enforcing the rules. So it's going to say, are you allowed to do this, yes or no? And it just let me, and it let me do it silently. So let's take a look at why. If I go in and look at the application manifest, there's this thing called capabilities. And you can see that I've selected none of them. But this isn't going to tell me the full truth. The full truth is over here. If I sort on flags, I have two capabilities. One of them is really, really hard to read, but the other one says quite clearly, your documents library. We've made the document the my documents capability something that was possible for some very specific targeted scenarios, but it wasn't designed to be used generically. But we let you. So for Windows 8.1, as we updated Visual Studio, we took it out of the UI so that people wouldn't go using it all the time. Despite the fact that it's not in the UI, It's still there. If I scroll to the bottom, I can see, oh, here's this capabilities list, and I added the documents library capability. I can get rid of that, rebuild it. And without that capability, I actually will not be able to write there. So the capabilities in the SID are what are checked by runtime broker. Hey, do you have this in your token, the capability to write here? If so, I'll go ahead and take care of it for you, no problem. If you don't have it, I'm not going to be able to allow it. So once we finish the rebuild, we'll be able to start this up. And you can see how well our sample apps have been over time. It's like, hey, there's all these things that we don't recommend you do anymore. Yeah, that's nice and useful there. And once we no longer have that capability, we'll deploy it. And we will, I don't need to debug it, we'll just launch it. And I can't do it anymore. You're not allowed. So I, as this process, now cannot get out of my box. So what we're trying to build are some partitions. Rather than just having low IL being this giant app soup area where everything can clobber each other, now we're putting walls in between them so they can't get into each other. And that's going to crash beautifully. Let's see what else happens. If I try to just write directly and not go through documents library and do my favorite thing as the app compat guy and hard code a path, because hard coded paths have never caused any problems. You know, everyone who's ever done app compat is like, yeah, yeah, never, that's never happened. Hard coded program files paths didn't have any problems at all going to 64-bit. If I try to write there directly, what's the problem? And if I just go ahead and get this running again, let's start without debugging. Oh, I said start with debugging. Okay, let's start without debugging. Cancel, stop. No, really, really stop. Here, let's just start it. That'll start without debugging. Awesome. Thank you for stopping. Unable to stop debugging. Really? Why not? There we go. If I try to go there directly, access denied. All right. Well, that's no problem. Let's take a look at what that was doing in process monitor. It's trying to create sample2.dat. If I go and take a look at that, let me add to the filter. Path contains. Oops. Contains. Sample2.dat. Let's clear it, start it running again, and take a look. What I'm trying to do now is I'm trying to write it directly from fileaccess.exe, and it's being walled off because of that low integrity. So let's go fix that. Let's go take our sample.dat, and let's copy, let's paste it, and we'll call it sample2.dat. Sample2.dat. And then let's go in and let's modify CHML sample2.dat and mark it to allow low integrity. That'll solve the problem, right? That'll solve the problem of integrity. I still get access denied because I'm in an app container. And what app container does, if I'm in the process, we saw how it has the runtime broker and it connects me up. But if I'm in the process itself and I'm trying to get out, it's not enough to be allowed low access, low privilege. My app container is going to add into my token an app container SID. And this app container SID is also going to be inspected. If I have an app container SID at all, come on, let me select all of you. There we go. If I have this at all, then the existence of an app container SID means I'm also in access check going to say access denied, which means if I want to be able to get access to that, what I have to do is change the access control list to grant that's
right click, paste. I am not going to type that. Full control to that app container. And once I've done that, oh, that's awesome. It'll still not work. Ah, I still made a typo with all of that care to copy and paste. Sample2.dat. And I'm able to make it. So those are my partitions, low integrity and the existence of an app container SID means I cannot break out of the sides unless someone lets me in. There's one entry for every single SID. So there's an identity, if you will, for every single process, a unique SID that will exist. It's based upon the application's name and publisher, and it's a big hash ID that gets computed. So it will be unique. Every app now has an identity. Starting with Windows Vista, we did that for services. So every service has an identity and a unique service SID. Now every app does if it's a Windows 8 app. So there is now app-based identity checks that you can put in and that will be durable, that persist and allow you to get past that. Even if we don't grant you, if you're going through a UI, we'll let you write. So that's the difference. So the runtime broker requires the capability to invisibly write stuff. If you let the user choose where to write it, runtime broker will write it for you. So if I look at, you know, how that worked, I can see that as well. In process monitor, right, I'll add to the filter, right, path contains sample 3.dat. There's a lot of data in here. I should probably clear it out. But once I have this in place, I'll clear it in a second. This is taking way too long. I'm getting bored, and I'm very easily bored. We'll clear it. And now when we go back and say, go through a dialog, write this file, we'll replace the existing file. I can see that this was not detected at all. That's awesome. What's that? Oh, it's me not being able to spell again. That's fantastic. Can someone else come up here and type for me? Sample 3. Yes. But that's going to go through the runtime broker as well. So I've got all of these rules. This is going through the picker host, which is going to allow it because the user chooses. I have to go through the runtime broker, and that's going to check our capabilities. If I do it directly, I have to open up all of these things. So we're starting to wall these things off. And not only does this apply to files, it's going to apply to window messages. I won't be able to send those. The other thing we had to do is we had to solve the problem that they could try to do some namespace squatting and create some objects and listen on them. So if you've ever used any of the synchronization objects in Windows, right? So if you're not a developer, you're probably like, I don't know what this guy's talking about right now. But if you're writing code, at the Windows level, you have these objects you use for synchronization. Create a file mapping object. And if you're the first one there, you now own it. You can set the ACLs however you want. If someone else tries to create one with the exact same name, they're going to open up yours. Now, if you've set your permissions that they can't, then they're just going to fail. But if they can, then they'll do it. And what the bad guys will do is they'll create the object first. They know someone else is going to come along and get, and they'll wait for them to connect. And then they'll listen on what's going on and potentially do bad things. So we go ahead and isolate those. So if we look at what we're doing in this file access, wrong one. I have this list of all of the objects on the bottom. And I created this thing called my event. And what we've done is we've made this new thing, app container named objects. And we've thrown in that app container SID, that giant one. And it's unique to this app. So if I call it my event and an app number 2 calls it my event, we both get different events called my event, even though we're in the same logon session. So we isolate it that way. So now we start to build these walls in between all of our applications so that if we go and get something and it turns out to be bad, they can't get out. Now, it's part. Now, can is a really, really strong term, so let me back up. This is part of a defense-in-depth holistic approach, which is we have technology to keep you isolated, so you can't just run havoc on the machine. You're contained, hence the name App Container. Technology alone is never enough. On top of the technology container are people in process. That's why there's an app store with a process to get in. We've all seen what happens if you have an app store where there's no barriers to getting in. People put bad things on there. So that's why we have curation in our public store. If you are distributing internally sideloaded apps, you are responsible for ensuring that the apps that you're putting out there are trusted before you put your digital signature on them. Now, if someone wants to run their own, how hard is it to run an arbitrary Windows 8 app on your device? For anyone who's sufficiently nerdy, it's really easy. Throw a dev license on there. They're free. And install whatever you want to. We're not taking away your freedom. We're defining an environment. So we are trying to say, our public store, we're going to do some certification to make sure there's some level of trust. Something might get through. But then we also have technology behind there just in case it does. Same thing on sideloaded apps. You're responsible for validating that. People and process and technology coming together to build a trusted story. So that's the foundational stuff. Now here's the problem and something that we've changed and now officially documented for 8.1. Update one, and please, I am not responsible for naming stuff within this company, right? 8.1 is an update, so I don't know why we do this, but this is the same people that decided that a good name for a few additional classes in .NET 2 would be a whole brand new version number, right? So there's something wrong with marketing people. I don't get them. Here's the problem that this solves. The isolation works really well. When you think about, how about transforming my company? Like what a lot of people start thinking of, they don't think of, I know what we can do. Let's get rid of all of our computers and buy all brand new touchscreens because I have an unlimited budget. And let's get rid of all of our apps and build all brand new ones. And let's just start over for Windows 8. How many people have said that? Precisely nobody ever. They all think, well, I've got a bunch of stuff I have that already works. And that's important to me. I invested a lot of money in building, you know, the typical well-managed environment has between 1,500 and 3,500 unique software packages depending upon the nature of their business. That's well-managed. I've seen very not well-managed companies. The largest, just in case it makes you feel any better, unless you're this company, the largest software inventory I've ever seen for installed Windows desktop apps was 225,000 unique apps. Do you feel better now? Because that's a lot of apps. But it's the worst I've seen. But still, well managed. 2,500, if I pick the spot dead in the middle, is a lot of things to throw away, a lot of investment. When I think about new scenarios, I'll give a real world example. I want to give my flight attendants on Emirates Airlines a tablet device that they can carry around to take orders to people. Well, there's already software to manage that, and they weren't going to throw it all out. You know what they did, despite the fact they were standing on stage and talking about the awesomeness of this scenario, is they cheated. Behind that Windows 8 app is all the same desktop apps they used to have before. They didn't rewrite all that stuff. They just did a loopback. And loopbacks were technically illegal. And we told you, we will fail you on store certification if you use a loopback. Which made everyone believe, oh my goodness, I can't do loopbacks. That's going to be a problem. Well, guess what? You can do loopbacks. Here are two ways that you can get back from your Windows Store apps in their isolated little box, legitimately back to your existing desktop apps. So now you can start thinking about, hey, here's a great app. All I need is really a new UI, right? I want to put, like, if I'm a bank, right? I want to have the teller have a touch screen so they can go really fast, but I'm not rewriting all the teller software. I just want to put a front end, and I'll just put a broker in between them. And here's what it could look like. Here is the broker host, and I'm going to go ahead and launch this guy. Are you going to rebuild me? That's awesome. Here we go. And it's going to sit here listening, and let's go ahead and enable it. That's fine. Go ahead and take your time. We're not in a hurry here. All right, so this thing is running and listening. Now, I don't need that guy. Let's go to our client. So we've run this. This is basically connecting us to an existing system. And I want to make a client that's able to attach to it. So this is going to launch. Before I actually execute it, I'm going to look at the properties of this. So the service reference, cancel. Configure. So I can see the configuration of this. This is just going through loopback, right? So I've set up a WCF service, and that WCF service is just running on the local machine. So I have an existing desktop app. I'm going to have to create the interface that it can talk to wire it up, right? Unless it already has some kind of service-based interface. I need that connection point. But with that connection point, now I can take my asset and talk back to it and say, you know what? Why don't I just write the UI, and boy, this is beautiful. Thank goodness I did that. Now I can touch it and go and get the list of all those things and get past that. I'm still in my container. I'm not rummaging through the file system. I'm just opening it up directly, but I'm able to loop myself back to a defined entry point and leverage my existing software assets to get past that. So that was, you know, for me as a nerd, kind of an exciting change that we did for 8.1, the update. So the new in the 8.1 update is we officially said, here it is in writing, it's okay for you to do this, right? We have these walls. There's more things you can do. The final thing I wanted to showcase was a feature, which I'm not going to demo because it requires a reboot, that's often misunderstood, and explain this a bit. So we take this concept of app container and isolation. Internet Explorer already runs in low integrity. It's done that since Windows Vista. Enhanced protected mode will additionally run it in an app container, which is going to further restrict what it's able to do. So when we look at, if you remember, we had a vulnerability which was, you know, had a few very specific targeted exploits out there, but nonetheless, everyone wanted to try and make sure that they weren't one of those people. Enhanced protected mode would have protected them from it. Here's the problem. The security features exist today to keep you really, really, really safe. Enhanced protected mode is really good at protecting you. Because not only are you blocking it by low integrity, you're blocking it by dropping it into an app container. Modern IE, and modern, not as a modern IE, the website, but the immersive interface that you get if you're using a touch-based device, typically, is already in an app container. That's a difference. Why does it not run add-ons? Because, A, we specifically disallow them, but even if we did allow them, most of them would break anyway. If I go and look at what we're doing, I can see that we have an app container surrounding IE. Enhanced protected mode does that for desktop IE as well, and rather inconveniently, just about everything breaks if you do that. If you have any ActiveX controls, any browser helper objects, they'll all likely fail. But this is sort of, to me, aspirational. Is here's this great feature. I can potentially get there. And it's creeping into the desktop side, except all of my stuff will break. And then we have the conflict between an application working and my environment being safe. But this is really the foundation. Right, so we started in Windows Vista, right? The initial change of assumption was we can't make any gains in security so long as the bad guy can just say, hey, I'm the admin. Let me just turn that feature off, which you could do. Get everyone to standard user, step one. UAC was designed to help with that. It was a hard step, and we know. Now we have standard users. Now it's let people install arbitrary stuff and not be as terrified anymore. And that's what our security infrastructure, that's what our process and our store and our sideloading story is designed to do. Let you trust, but make the barriers as permeable as they need to be for you to leverage the assets that you've been investing in Windows for 20 or 30 years. So with that, thank you very much for coming out this morning, and happy to take any questions. Thank you. You've been a great audience. And I'll ask a question, too. Was that helpful? Because I always feel bad. Here's the Windows 8 talk, and the first 45 minutes is Vista stuff. But it's the Vista stuff that no one gets. Yeah, there's a question. How does Emmet fit into all of this? So Emmet is a security feature that turns on a bunch of additional features, like address space layout randomization, which is sort of an opt-in thing. It says, you know what, do it to this one, no matter what. So it allows me to say, I'm going to force it. So it, again, puts you in this position of deciding between compatibility and security. If we turn it on everywhere, tremendously secure, as would hucking your computer in a ditch and filling it with concrete, right? That's sort of the problem that we come in on is if your environment works, great, you'll be much more secure and maybe even can configure the entire environment to get there eventually. But it's turning on a bunch of features, some of which are compiler level, some of which are OS level, to say apply these here no matter what, just in case. And Emmet's evolving really, really quickly. And we're starting to differentiate when we think about security between truly high security environments and productivity environments, which are different. So you're starting to see these different zones where we look to protect the real goods rather than trying to make everything an impenetrable box when really all you're protecting is someone writing a bunch of memos about HR-related, you know, events. And you're like, I don't actually need to protect that. Why do I have us all locked down? Yep. Other questions? Comments? Thoughts? Well, with that, thank you again, and have a great rest of TechEd. See you at the party tonight.